Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm, and on today's show, I am thrilled to welcome back Mr. Rob Tull, who talks us through what's in the complete compliance toolkit that every CCO needs to help build an effective compliance program. In our headline section, we review recent comments from the SEC's Enforcement Division responding to criticisms from the crypto industry. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of Outtakes, where we look at the first-of-its-kind enforcement action against investment advisors for misleading statements about their use of artificial intelligence. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, SEC Director Gurbir Graywald defended the Division of Enforcement against criticisms from the crypto industry challenging the agency's authority, motivations, and integrity. During the recent SEC Speaks event sponsored by the Practicing Law Institute, Mr. Graywald said the SEC faced headwinds from crypto industry participants who were trying to avoid SEC compliance. He went on to say that the SEC has, quote, confronted significant noncompliance and many creative attempts by market participants to avoid our jurisdiction, with some claiming that we are making it up as we go or regulating by enforcement, and others arguing that we are recklessly exceeding our authorities, end quote. Mr. Graywald further argued that the test to determine whether crypto is a security is the Howey test, not the essential ingredients test or a Beanie Baby test or any other test that industry folks might like to try to create for themselves. He further argued that Americans have good reason to be concerned about crypto, citing to some specific SEC crypto enforcement actions and a Pew Research Center survey, which found that nearly a third of Americans who had invested in crypto no longer held any crypto, and three quarters of Americans who had heard about crypto do not believe that it is reliable or safe. He went on to say that, quote, crypto enforcement actions have not been and are not without challenge, end quote, citing to a recent court decision which allowed the SEC to proceed with its lawsuit against Coinbase. Mr. Graywald also criticized the treatment of marginalized communities by the crypto industry, arguing that the crypto industry uses, quote, predatory inclusion tactics, including spreading unsupported narratives or other positions that, quote, crypto will increase financial inclusion, that it will uplift the unbanked or underbanked, and that it will help these different types of communities build wealth and increase upward mobility, end quote. What I find interesting, maybe most interesting, about Director Graywald's comments is that I do agree that we are, in fact, talking likely about the same issue or the same problem, but I don't think it's under the same context. By way of example, Mr. Graywald talks about crypto market participants essentially wanting a different set of rules than those that apply to everyone else. And I think many of the folks in the crypto industry would probably agree directly with that sentiment, thinking that essentially the regulations that apply to crypto assets right now should not be the same types of rules and regulations that are applied to corporates, which also don't have the same rules that apply to private fund, to investment funds, which don't have the same that apply to, you know, asset-backed securities. As indicated by Stephen Lofty in Regulatory Intelligence blog, good regulators have to design regulations that work for particular products. If the SEC devised a more workable regulatory scheme to oversee crypto, developers would likely comply. In the absence of a regulatory scheme that is effectively managing those types of assets, which the SEC doesn't appear to have a huge interest in developing, crypto developers have really no other choice other than to argue against the Howey test. Whatever disagreements Mr. Graywald may have against those participating in the crypto markets right now, I think many of those same market participants could likely point to their own share of evidence that the SEC has not always acted in good faith with respect to its treatment of crypto assets. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we thought it might be really helpful for some of our listeners to go back to some of the things that help really build out an effective compliance program And to help us, to help guide us through this conversation, we are very, very pleased to welcome back to the show, Mr. Rob Toll, to really help give us a toolkit and help explain all of the different things that go into building an effective compliance program, not just some of the technical parts, which of course is another part of this show that we sometimes focus on. But to begin, Rob, thank you so much for joining us here on the show. We'd love to have you give you just real quick opportunity to talk a little bit about your, you know, kind of program and, you know, what you're up to.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick. It's great to be here again. I love these conversations. They're always a lot of fun, for as fun as compliance can be. And yeah, so right now my focus of my energy is helping compliance professionals and compliance programs become value add differentiators for their organizations. Like, I'm really focused on that. And it's really combating the industry. You know, we hear a lot of this, compliance is a cost center. And that's when it's only done to check the box. But when you actually dig into the skill set of compliance and what real compliance professionals bring to the table, they're an asset to an organization. And so I really work with professionals and organizations and helping to make sure that compliance is viewed as an asset. And it's just, it really is. It's something I'm just terribly passionate about.
Well, I think it is certainly, especially for this audience. I mean, you know, you are doing the good work, you know, so to speak. Yeah. I think this is definitely a very friendly audience, and one that would absolutely be receptive to that. And honestly, part of the reason that I think, you know, I'm so excited about getting to hear from you on some of the different ways that folks might be able to help do that inside of their compliance programs as we dig into the conversation today. And so I guess maybe to kind of kick things off, you know, I would love to hear, you know, kind of looking at it holistically, right? And if you take a step back, and, you know, I think for many of the listeners of this show, I'm sure they are, you know, intimately familiar now with the new SEC marketing rule, or at least the general analysis of it. They're intimately familiar with the Advisors Act compliance rule. What are the three things you need, right? And they're intimately familiar with some of the other basic elements of their program. But running an effective compliance program top to bottom involves so much more than that, right? And my, I guess, to kick off the conversation, you know, and I realize this is a very broad question, but, you know, what does it take to have an effective compliance program?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really is. And it's nothing that is spelled out explicitly in the regulations that at least we use to navigate, right? Everything that we use to navigate basically says, is your compliance program adequately designed and is it operating effectively? And that's all it says. And it says, you need to be a CCO. And by the way, here is a laundry list of rules, some of which are rules-based, some of which are principles-based. Create your checklist, follow it. And the wonderful thing is that's a lot of guidance on what. That's not a guidance on how. And so how is really where we as compliance professionals, that's the value add we have. We are the how. And so when we start to look around for how do we navigate that, one of the areas that I go to immediately was the sentencing guidelines, the federal sentencing guidelines from the Department of Justice for corporate compliance programs. Because if you look back to the history of the compliance rule for investment advisors, broker dealers, and investment companies, and, you know, and by extension, private fund advisors, they are built on a foundation that we actually don't see in the regulation, which is it's built on two schools of thought, one of which is this federal sentencing guidelines. The other piece is enterprise risk management and structure of internal controls by COSO. So when you look at it this way and you say, well, what do I need to demonstrate in an effective compliance program? There's a series of steps. And it's, you know, that's where we get our concept of risk assessment. Like, risk assessment is baked into compliance through the rule, but it's not actually articulated anywhere. But if you look at the federal sentencing guidelines, having a risk assessment and risk awareness is one of the keystones to having a well-designed compliance program. And so I like to use those guidelines, and there's seven guidelines that I like to use to navigate. And what's really important is it covers the continuum of a compliance lifecycle, where it goes from risk assessment to adopting policies and procedures, to communicating them, to training on them, to monitoring them, to reporting to management. Like, all of that stuff that we have pieced together from speeches and other things are actually really clearly articulated in these sentencing guidelines. But what's the most fascinating piece is when it talks about what is an effective compliance professional or compliance officer. And, you know, for the SEC, when we look at our, you know, 20647, 3881 guidance, you get the idea of it, they need to be knowledgeable and empowered. But that's only knowledgeable, empowered, and then there's kind of two other pieces that sometimes appear, other times don't appear, which is they need to be competent and they need to be adequately resourced. Those are huge topics that are not like defined with any kind of criteria. Yeah. And it basically says, like, so if you think about the rules and you think about like, well, what's an effective compliance program? Okay, well, I can go through these, this kind of like ecosystem of compliance, and I can check all these boxes. And then it says, okay, person at the center, CCO, who we've put at the center, you need to have these four criteria. You need to be knowledgeable, competent, empowered, and adequately resourced. Good luck. And that's it. That's the only guidance we get.
Right. Yeah. So I love the way that you've framed that, because I do think it is important, because it certainly highlights the fact that there is so much that is ultimately being placed on chief compliance officers right now. Right. And what the kinds of skills are that make up a compliance professional. And so I know, you know, you just really laid out some effective things that need to be that, you know, we were talking about what makes an effective compliance program. And some of these different things that are characteristics and part of the skill set for a CCO. But I guess if you had to define, you know, like, what are the four attributes, the four different attributes that you look for in an effective compliance professional, how would you define those kind of attributes? What are the kinds of things that you're looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think about it, and a lot of this, what I look for, it's kind of like what I look in the mirror for, right? So if I had to stack these things in priority, the first thing is, do I know the rules? Like, am I knowledgeable, right? So is a compliance officer knowledgeable? And knowledgeable's, that's kind of, it's rough. There's layers to that. The first thing is, do you know the regs that apply to your business? And that's where, you know, that's where there's a ton of content from NSCP, from law firms, from consulting firms. Like, we get that. We get the knowledge. But then there's two layers on top of that. Then there's also, do you know the industry you're in? Like, it's one thing to know the rules, but do you know what's going on in the industry? What's happening for investment managers and broker dealers in aggregate? And then what's happening in your business? Like, you need to know your business. And that's kind of like the foundation, like that knowledge piece. And so I would always ask myself, Rob, do you know the regs? Do you know what's going on? And do you feel in touch with the business? Really basic. Then the next thing is really where I started to see that this is where we don't get a lot of guidance. And it's, what does it mean to be competent? Like, I can be knowledgeable. Fair enough. I go to conferences. I take my CEUs. Now, what is it to be competent? Ooh, geez, that's coming from the government, you know, that's a sword and a shield. So I look at that and I basically have spent a number of years breaking it down, and it comes down to four criteria. And it really comes down to communication skills, your ability to have awareness, your ability to have like adaptability, and then judgment. And the reason I put it in that order is communication is kind of a two-way street, right? It's the language we speak. If I do not know how to communicate things as a compliance officer, and when I mean communicate, I mean that I have to be fluent with diverse audiences. How I communicate something to my management team is totally different than how I communicate it to a client, to a regulator. So like I have to have really strong communication skills, and I have to know how to process information. In other words, I have to know how to read these sometimes incomprehensible rules and decipher them. I need to be able to hear bits and pieces of information from people in meetings and know what that means from a compliance perspective. Oh, hey, there's a new product, or hey, we just hired this salesperson, or hey, like, you got to know how to process information. So communication is kind of like one. And then like the next piece is like, well, now that you have language, are you aware? Do you have situational awareness? Can you figure out, do you have risk awareness? Can I look at a situation and be like, ooh, that's not good, or no risk there? And can I watch what's happening within the business to say, wow, it seems like we are evolving in a way that I now need to react as a compliance professional or influence? And then I think about adaptability, in that not just the regulations change constantly, the industry, the business changes constantly. And so whatever, I think any one of us can sit down and say, what were my priorities at the beginning of 2022 before a number of those rules were finalized? And then say, now what were my priorities at the end of 23? So over the course of 24 months, radically different.
Right.
So you have to have the ability to kind of like negotiate and navigate changing priorities and attention areas. And then lastly is judgment. How do I take those three things, my ability to communicate, my awareness, and my ability to like react and be flexible, and now how do I make decisions? And because that's really the key, because compliance officers are really tested based on the decisions they make. And a lot of times it's a question of, oh, did I make the right decision? And that, you know, that's not actually the right question. The right question is, did I make the best decision possible at that time? Because we're never operating with total information. So that's just like kind of a quick spiel on kind of knowledge and competence. And then obviously we build on top of that with empowerment and then resourcing. And empowerment is its own animal, and so is resourcing. But I'll pause right there, because I know that I threw a lot out in that. Cracking open competence into those four areas is a lot.
It is, but I honestly really like the way that you framed it. And I think what it touches on that I think is so important is that there are some parts of serving as a chief compliance officer as a compliance officer that, you know, you're able to get out of a textbook, right? You're able to get out of reading the statute, trying to understand what it's saying, provide a proper interpretation, et cetera. But there's a lot of being a compliance officer that it's going to come through experience. It's going to come through at-bats. It's going to come through being willing to sometimes raise your hand and to do different things and to get involved and to help the business in different areas. And like, again, for instance, you talk about awareness, right? And curiosity, and like, what is your radar doing, right? You know, if you're asking questions like why or how something is happening and you're not exactly sure what it is, it's likely worth the follow-up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's probably like there's something going off in your mind that's like hitting a little button or a little ding or a little light that's going on. And you're thinking, you know what? That's probably something I want to dig into a little bit more. It's also, you know, you talk about communication skills and how you communicate. And obviously, you look, that's not something that's going to be novel, that communication is key. But I think it's worth repeating, because as compliance officers, and especially in today's world where, you know, there's so much email and there's so much other ways that you can connect with people that feel, you know, impersonal, and to be able to have kind of direct communications with those persons that are ultimately part of the group that is, you know, helping you with your compliance program, or that is at the firm. And obviously, again, while there are certain people dedicated to compliance inside that firm, everybody has to practice compliance inside that firm. And so your ability to communicate with those individuals is so critical to the ultimate success of building an effective compliance program, that it's not something you can just kind of, you know, slough off to the side. And you know, again, you talk about judgment, obviously having a good governor there. But again, being able to be willing to follow up and take those steps, I think is really important. And so, you know, I know there are those other aspects of, you know, empowerment and resources and stuff like that. And I mean, shoot, you know, we just got done one of our prior episodes at the end of season 4 was looking at the issue of CCO liability, right? And whether or not CCOs have, you know, adequate resources, whether CCOs are, you know, appropriately empowered by the firm management to do the things that they need to do. So, no, I think that's really effective. And I really like the way that you frame that there. When you think about, as we, the kind of, you know, that's probably a good segue to actually, let's dig into that issue of empowerment. You know, how, I think that is something that, you know, you articulated near the top, that there's a lot about being a compliance officer and a chief compliance officer that's difficult to teach, and that you can't just pick up from kind of reading a statute. I think one of the things at the top of that list is this notion of empowerment and understanding what it means. So my question for you is, if you were a new, you know, chief compliance officer, or even to a seasoned one, but maybe you're taking on a new job. Or even for those listeners on the podcast that might be new to the compliance industry as a whole, and you're taking your first job as a compliance officer, how does a compliance professional become empowered?
That is a great question. And you're right. I work with so many compliance officers that are either new in the role or in a new situation. And the beauty about empowerment is we tend to think once I'm the named CCO, I am by default empowered. That's what we tend to get because the rules are title focused, we get title focused. But what we forget is that title has nothing to do other than who gets to wear the target. What it really talks to is our ability to be empowered is our ability to demonstrate. It's how well we demonstrate our competence and our knowledge. And it's not an ivory tower task. It is a, what do you bring to the business as a value add to take compliance from a checklist to make it something that is additive to the business? And that is the most important thing. And it's not just, and this is beyond the concept of profitability, beyond that concept. It is, how do you make the organization better top to bottom? And so there's a couple ways we do that. And so when we think about, if I'm a new CCO, and this is one of the first things I talk to kind of new people that are new in roles, the first thing to do is you got to start to understand how management views the business and how they view compliance, because you really need to get an understanding of that. And it's not that you need to advocate. It's that you need to understand, what are you dealing with? What are the personality types? How do they make decisions? How do they see the future for the business? And how do they see compliance? And when I think about that, people tend to fall into kind of two categories. I think of anecdotal people and analytical people, right? So generally, management people tend to come to the table with either a, why do I need to do this? Or what does that information mean for me? Kind of like those two different things. And understanding that's really a big key, because if you can understand that, you can then adjust your communication to make sure that you are communicating in a way that that person understands, like you're communicating on their channel. So that the first step is get to know management, what their views are, and how they see compliance. Then that essentially lays out the schematics for what do I then need to demonstrate in order for them to invest trust in me? Because that's the other thing. Like, empowerment really comes from being embraced. You need people to trust you. And so I think of this as servant leadership. That's always how I thought about compliance. You're a servant leader, is that we step into the gaps that the business has, and we're able to provide guidance, assurance, and security. So that way the business can continue to operate. And when you make yourself a presence that demonstrates confidence, capability, competence, the ability to communicate, when you can demonstrate those things repeatedly in a way that management understands, you are seeding empowerment. And it doesn't matter what your title is, it's because they start to trust you. And once you become trusted, that is the key. And then the other piece to that, so that is kind of how you kind of move that internally with management. But then there's the, what do I do myself? What do I do as just the individual that helps foster empowerment? And really what that is leaning into my identity and ownership of the ethics and compliance program as the ambassador, right? I have to be the ambassador of the program, which means I got to walk the talk. Like, I have to be the guy that is calm in crisis, that is decisive, who makes good decisions, who is service oriented. That's what it's going to take. And it's kind of like those two strategies, the understanding how the organization is structured and functions and sees things, and adjusting your behavior to adapt to that, while still becoming a brand of compliance and ethics myself. Those two things build empowerment regardless of title.
I really like the way that you framed so much of your response there. And one of the things that actually it brings to mind that we've talked about on this show in a couple of different instances, but you know, that layer of trust that a compliance officer can generally earn, I would say, you know, that they achieve and they earn from working with the business. I have most often found that that can occur not only when, you know, compliance officers, and as you say, kind of step in to fill in the gaps and to really be a trusted resource to help provide guidance. And oftentimes that guidance can be setting the guardrails, right? Of like where you can go as a business, how far you can push, what the risks are if you want to push maybe a little farther, but there are potential business or economic benefits or other places where, you know, again, that's a bit of a gray area. But it's always, I have always found you start to build that trust more and really, you know, become a true business partner, a trusted resource for the business when you can not only tell them where the guardrails are at, but also come with solutions to like come with available options, right? Of like, ultimately the business needs to be the ones that are making the decision on what they're going to do. But if you say, look, I know you want to get from A to B, you know, we can't do it this way, but if you did want to do it, there are these other ways that we could do it, right? And sometimes, look, of course, I get it that like there are some situations where the answer, you have to plant the flag and you got to say no, and you can't. There are right. some that you can't get back. But to the extent that you can, even when you have to say no in a situation, provide them with an alternative route to help them get to the ultimate business level solution that they were looking for. Man, oh man, that goes such a long way, because then the business starts to recognize like, hey, that's Pat, my compliance officer, you know, not just saying no to my idea. They're saying yes, if we are able to do these things, right? Or if we can meet these certain conditions, and they start to look at you like a partner. You know, I don't know if you've ever experienced that or if you think that that's accurate, but I definitely think that's one way you can really build that trust and help them empower you more to be involved in those.
Absolutely. I mean, you're dead on with that, because that is the key. It's not if we limit ourselves to being a binary response bot where it's yes, no, then that's how we will be treated. And if we think of ourselves in a bigger problem set, and we think of ourselves of, I am a problem solver who is used to figuring out how things can happen, not whether they should, but how. Now that's a completely different skill set I bring to the table. So when someone says, hey, we're thinking of moving into this market with this type of product for this type of client base, and we step back and say, if my initial reaction is no, okay, that I'm not going to get empowered. If I look at that and say, well, it depends. There's ways that we can do that, and there's ways that we can't. So what is, and this is where it's really key, because solving problems, the thing is, when we are presented with questions, we're often presented as if we are being asked for permission. And so that is a yes, no thing. But where we are really additive in terms of a value perspective is if we understand the why. What is the reason we're doing this thing? What is the reason the business wants to do this? Because now if the business says, well, we're trying to get into capturing this piece of the market that we currently have had trouble getting access to and whatever. So what they're doing is they're presenting what they think is their best option. And so as the compliance officer, if I just kill that best option and don't offer an alternative, I'm preventative. But if I say, well, that option doesn't work, but another option could work, and I still get the same result, the why, right. Now I am additive to the business, because I am able to take my little inventory of rules and stuff, and I am able to give them an answer that fits their business, as opposed to just ChatGPT response, which is no, like that's not helpful. And so when we are presented, and that's why things like awareness, communication, judge, like all that stuff comes into play, yeah. Because having all of that foundation, now when I'm at the table and somebody asks me a question and I provide value instead of just an answer, that's when they say, that's the person we trust. That's the person that's part of the team. And so, that's only built through experience. Just like you said, like that is the at bats. That's right. What that takes.
Yeah. As you think about, you know, the different things, because getting those at bats and, you know, being able to build that trust, to build that rapport, to become, you know, a valued resource and partner by the business certainly takes a lot of time. And it's going to be both, you know, your level of effort, but it also could be at certain times, you know, the resources, right, that you have available, you can bring to the table and that have at your disposal. As you think about some of those things that if you're a compliance professional, again, in kind of some of the scenarios that we've talked about, you know, how do you have any kind of tips or tricks or recommendations for, you know, our listeners and those compliance professionals out there? So like, how can they make the most of available resources, especially when, you know, as you articulated at the top, oftentimes the compliance department can be operating on a pretty limited budget. Right. And so, yeah. So what are some ways that compliance professionals can make the most of the available resources?
Yeah, that's great. Cause you're right. Honestly, the way I think about it is we are often given about 20% of the resources that can do about 80% of the work. And so, and it's that 80-20 rule, right? So that's kind of where we live. So when you think about it, we're always going to be under-resourced. And a very kind of flip way to think about it is beg, borrow, steal. Right. And so it's I could beg, borrow, steal for resources, but there's a kind of more intelligent way to go about that. Right. So that's kind of, that's the brick through the storefront window. That's it. Not very elegant, but effective.
Right. Yeah. Right.
but we want to be nice and slick about it. We want to be the Fuller Brush man. We want to be the Cutco sales guy. We want that. And so there's a couple layers that I think about. The first thing is getting familiar with all the different operations in the business. And what I mean by operations is, I mean, within an organization, there's an ecosystem, right? There's all the different departments that relate to each other. And it's getting familiar with each of those departments, the topography across the entire organization of who's generating what, who's controlling what information, how's part of the process. And then taking our knowledge of designing processes and procedures and controls and looking at those things and saying, what can I leverage that exists already in the infrastructure that I can then capitalize on and say, I can either rely on that for a compliance control, I can then borrow that for a compliance control, or I can copy that idea for a compliance control, right? That's kind of how I go through that. And so what that allows us to do is kind of understand what's available, what's already in the house that I can play with. Now I then find my shortfall. Okay, well, where am I short? Okay, what can get filled by myself? What can get filled by my team or other teams? And then what do I need to outsource? And then there's this gap, right? There's going to be a shortfall. And what we want is that shortfall to fall within my appetite range, right? It's the idea that fits within my risk appetite and I'm willing to take that on because no matter what happens to it, I can deal with, I can manage the consequence of it. So if I don't have resources for it, I can at least manage it. So think of that as like your car insurance policy, right? I can't prevent all accidents, but I can make sure I've got coverage in the event that something happens. And so when I think about that big borrow steal and like, where do I fill in the gaps? You know, I think a lot of us will look at something like our annual risk assessment. And when we look at our annual risk assessment, when we go through and we start to allocate, well, what controls are in place and what risks are mitigated, we usually end up in a spot where we think, well, I got to do it. And we over allocate ourselves, right? So we treat ourselves like we're an elastic budget, right? So I might look at my compliance inventory of available resources and realize, wow, Rob, you are short essentially, you know, the equivalent of 2 person hours, you know, I mean, like I'm short 2 people in terms of the work I do. And I just assume, well, I guess that's my job, which is asinine. So it's knowing how to actually manage myself to say, well, I can't do the job of two people except for a short period of time. And then I do no one's job. So it's how do I manage my available resource to get done those critical tasks? And so, yeah, it's a little bit of the beg, borrow, steal, and then managing my own resource allocation in a smart way instead of in this infinite budget way.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And I think certainly very insightful. You know, I think too, in this kind of gets, you know, to a little bit of what we were talking about before too, about, you know, how to build rapport or show yourself as a trusted resource and add value in that way. And again, be able to kind of become empowered from the management. But another part of using available resources that I know I have also found really effective is when you go and reach out to those other department heads or to the other people that are in the different business units that you're aiming to serve as part of your compliance program. What's interesting is that I also sometimes think compliance officers can get stuck in this mantra of, I'm the compliance person, I have to own every part of this, and I need to take it all on ourselves. Like, it's all on my shoulders. Like, the entire thing is on my shoulders. And certainly there is, I mean, some of that. Certainly, again, you are the primary liaison between the staff and your firm when it comes to that. And you are the person directing and administering the program. But when you think about, again, I'll take an area like marketing. Okay. Perfect area of example here. Like, if I've got a chief marketing officer at the firm, what I want to understand in a way that will help me maximize the resources I have available is if the people that are in that marketing department, if I can get one feedback from them about how to build a more effective, maybe marketing review process or other stuff like that, not only will they start to value me more, right, in a way when I think they can kind of, you build that rapport and that trust to be a valued resource and everything else, but also you might be able to maximize your resources better because that marketing department may have people on that team that either know the marketing rule already or that you can train on the marketing rule. And so all of a sudden now, when you would be getting in marketing, a piece of marketing advertising or collateral, and it comes in and you've got to send it back and it looks like a bloodbath, right, on it, because it's just like, it's just totally so far afield from where it would be from a compliance perspective. Or maybe you have somebody in that marketing department who knows what they're doing or that you can train to understand the rule better. And now they're able to take some of that lift off of you so that whoever puts it together in the marketing department, it goes through that person and that person is able to do some of that initial vetting for you and you get it. And it's a much better piece by the time it makes its way to you, so that cuts down on your review time. And it's also, you're not like adding to the firm's bottom line, right? You're not adding additional expense to the firm's bottom line. So I love that idea of, like, you know, also kind of maybe partnering with other business units or understanding, like you were describing, like what some of your resources are there. I think that can also be really helpful too.
Yeah. And the example you just gave with marketing, that is the perfect example, because in the situations where I've been able to do this now repeatedly, and it's been wonderful. And when you get to understand, when you look at those departments, right? So you talk to the marketing team, and there's kind of two primary questions you want to ask as a compliance person. Why are things done the way they are? Understand the history of why that workflow developed the way it did. Because don't just take it for granted that you're smarter than the workflow people. Understand why, because oftentimes there's some sort of operational efficiency or error or something that influenced how that came about. And then the second question to ask is, where's the pain? Where's the pain point? So not only why did things evolve the way they did, but where is there friction and pain? Because now as a compliance officer, if I can still learn from the lessons of what influenced the workflow and I can minimize pain, I am now increasing the value I contribute. And in that, your idea of what I call forward deployment, right? Take a compliance activity. So a pain point that I would hear is, well, compliance has to review every presentation and those reviews take 24 hours or more. Well, yeah, when the compliance officer gets 10 presentations a day, yeah, you need 24 hour turnaround. And then it's like, okay, well, let's forward deploy that review into the marketing team. That's going to require training somebody. Okay, I'm going to borrow a resource, train them. Well, now that turnaround is significantly faster. Compliance is not a bottleneck. And now we both got something we wanted, which is I wanted increased capacity. You wanted a quicker turnaround. You're now empowered for that quicker turnaround. And we have a completely different dynamic now. We're partners as opposed to a toll booth. And right. So it's this idea of that's how we leverage the existing resources to accomplish goals in a way that everybody wins at the table. Yeah. And that's kind of that strategy then gets replicated in different departments for different things.
Yeah. So that, that leads into, this, I got a big question to kind of, as we look to mm-hmm. kind of close up our conversation. And again, thank you. Super insightful, discussion, but it reminds me of, there can be so many things involved in the role of a chief compliance officer. And obviously, as we've discussed, right, there's a lot of both objective and subjective kind of skill sets that a person can have in order to effectively do the role. If you were going to provide a couple maybe hidden skills or kind of other areas maybe not often looked at, but that you believe and that you've seen maybe even anecdotally that can provide, an outsized impact for a compliance professional inside a firm, right? For someone who's either stepping into a role, maybe it's someone that's even been in an existing role for a long time, but they're again looking to really kind of enhance the footprint that they have in the firm and getting back to things like, empowerment and autonomy and authority and stuff like that. What's a hidden skill set or something like that can provide, again, that kind of outsized impact for a compliance professional?
Absolutely. And that's probably the single most important question. And it's because how do we be compliance professionals? And I think if I had to summarize it in one word, it's heart. But what I mean by that is we have to own who we are as people and show up in our best version. People end up in compliance. So if you were to step back and say, let's take a macro look at the kind of person who ends up in compliance, usually they're people with a lot of integrity and a strong moral compass. Generally speaking, they care about rules. They care about doing things a certain way. There tends to be a concept of right and wrong just innate in them. It's somebody who clearly is comfortable taking accountability and responsibility for things, right? Because you can't agree to put on that target unless you are comfortable being the kind of person who is used to taking responsibility and accountability. You also have to have a sense of independence. Like, you have to be willing to know at some point I'm going to be standing toe to toe with someone who is my superior, and I'm going to deliver hard information that they don't want to hear, that they are likely going to disagree with. And I have to be independent enough to know that I can still express I can still communicate what needs to be communicated, and I'm willing to put myself in that situation. So, and I'm probably a helper. Like, at the end of the day, I'm probably the kind of person who likes to help people. So if I think about that, I have a strong moral compass. I like to help. I'm good at being independent. Like, those things, like, lean into those. As compliance people, they tend to be innate for us. They tend to be natural fits. And when they are, the more we lean into those attributes, the more we actually perform our job better, the more we're actually able to display our real value. We're not just rules people. We're not just people who can kind of recite a statute or a rule or tell them we shouldn't be doing that. We're actually able to be our best version of ourselves. And so I think if I were to put that under one category, it'd be heart. And it's like, when we show up for this job and we're willing to be responsible and to basically take the firm under our wing is essentially what we're agreeing to do, lean into that. Because when you do that with a level of confidence, people can't help but trust you. They can't help but see, wow, you are really here to make us better. You're not here to just bust our stones. This is an additive relationship. And so I think if I had to say what's the secret ingredient that separates kind of the good compliance officer from the exceptional one really leans into their natural attributes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think, again, when you are serving in that kind of role, and, you know, the other one that I'll add to that, because I think that's exactly right. But I you know, folks that consistently show up when they're asked, and, you know, that, you know, they're not like you've described, they're not just there to put up a roadblock, right, or whatever else, but they consistently show up and they do so coming with ideas, providing guidance on where the guardrails are at, providing guidance on these things that obviously the firm needs to be aware of and needs to make sure that they're considering as they go into a new type of initiative or a new type of activity. But being there and consistently showing up is really, really helpful to, again, gain that level of credibility with the business, where they feel like, you know what, if I ask this person, I know I can rely on them and that they're going to be there. And yeah. I think that's so important. As we, you know, as we wrap up here, you know, and think about, you know, back to our original question of, you know, what does it take to have an effective compliance program? We've talked about, you know, the four attributes of an effective compliance professional. We've talked about, you know, the kind of different four sub elements of competence and what that means, how we can empower compliance professionals. But, you know, are there any other items or anything else you'd like to add about kind of what it takes to build an effective compliance program?
Yeah, I think as an effective compliance program, it's really understanding that, like, you need to be attached to the business and it needs to be dynamic and I need to be willing to navigate this thing. It's never going to be static. It's just not going to be. There's going to be some aspects of it that are iterative, but an effective compliance program is always going to match the needs of the business, the needs of the people within the business, the needs of the regulatory environment, and the needs of clients. And so if I can build something that has that level of flexibility and I'm willing to navigate it as the CCO or as kind of the lead compliance person, that's going to be a difference maker for my business. That's when they're going to step back and say, this is a piece that we thought was just the cost of doing business, but now is actually part of our asset. Like, the quality that we bring to the market is this thing. It's that intangible. I think that's probably the biggest piece I'd say.
Yeah, no, that's great. And again, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and share some of these insights. I know that our listeners will be better for it and greatly appreciate you coming on the show. Now, I wouldn't be doing my job well if I just let you get off with talking about, you know, some of the different aspects about what builds an effective compliance program. What's maybe a really good book or a really good movie or show that you've been, you know, digging into a lot recently, or something that you're, you know, interested?
Well, my guilty pleasures are things that are like TV shows, like the Marvel's TV shows and the Star Wars TV shows. I'm a comic nerd and a Star Wars nerd at heart. Those are things I consume religiously. And then watch content covering that content, which is a little ridiculous. so that's how I've been getting through. But I will say, like, from a personal development perspective, there is a book now that I'm using for the second year in a row. That's like a productivity book called The One Thing that I have found extremely helpful. And cool. Yeah, and I've been coupling that with some of the other coaching models that I use, and it's just been wonderful. It's allowed me to kind of put my plan out for 2024 and say, what are all the goals that are out there? And the one thing I love to do is create goals that have nothing to do with work and no goals that are hard, you know? So I'll just rattle off something that's sitting in front of me right now. So I promised myself that I would build more Legos this year.
Nice.
Those are like, that's a goal because that's a fun thing to do. Yeah. And spend more time hiking and biking. So I think for compliance people particularly, you know, so much of our life is wrapped up in stress and this kind of anxious toil that we get stuck in because of rules and the nature of our job, that remembering that we're allowed to play in our free time is really important, because, you know, it's hard if we just want to carry responsibilities on our shoulders all the time. That's how you get crushed. So you got to take those responsibilities off occasionally and have a little fun. And so that tends to be where my free time goes.
I love it. No, I love it. I think those are, one, that's a fantastic goal, anything involving Legos. Number two, very great points. And certainly for those listeners, would definitely make sure that you continue to keep your mind and body right, both, you know, as you think about what you're doing professionally, but certainly what you're doing for yourself personally. And then finally, to add on to your thing, you know, I recently binge watched Andor, which was legit.
Amazing.
Really strong for those Star Wars fans out there. So, Rob, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really just fantastic conversation, and look forward to having you know, back on the show here at some point down the road.
Absolutely, Patrick. I love this. I love chatting with you, man. It's great.
The final part of today's show features another segment of Outtakes. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, if compliance were a TV show, think of this as the bloopers reel, where we look at entertaining, sometimes humorous, and typically unsettling activities carried out at financial services firms that hopefully provide us all with a roadmap of what not to do when facing a similar situation or trying to avoid a similar compliance breakdown inside our respective firms. Essentially, leave these activities on the cutting room floor and outside your compliance program. In today's Outtakes, we're breaking new frontiers as we look at the first of its kind enforcement action against investment advisors for misleading statements about their use of artificial intelligence. On March 18, 2024, the SEC announced settled charges against two investment advisors for making false and misleading statements about their alleged use of artificial intelligence in connection with providing investment advice. As we mentioned a moment ago, these settlements are the SEC's first ever cases charging violations of the anti-fraud provisions of the federal securities laws in connection with AI disclosures, and also include the first settled charges involving AI in connection with the marketing and compliance rules under the Advisors Act. These matters really start to reflect Chair Gensler's determination to target, quote, AI washing, which is securities fraud in connection with AI disclosures under existing provisions of the federal securities laws, and also underscore Chair Gensler's sentiment that public companies, investment advisors, and broker-dealers will face rapidly increasing scrutiny from the SEC in connection with their AI disclosures, policies, and procedures. In both cases, the SEC charged firms with violations of 2062 of the Advisors Act, which is the anti-fraud provision, for false and misleading claims about the use of AI in connection with their investment advisory services, as well as with the marketing rule and the compliance rule failures in connection with these misstatements. So what are some of the key takeaways here for firms looking to help mitigate against potential SEC enforcement risk in connection with their own AI disclosures? And a special shout out to Deb Voice and Plimpton for putting together this excellent list. Number one, be clear and accurate as to what you do and don't use AI for. Number two, avoid using hypothetical language for actual AI practices. Using hypothetical language to indicate the possibility of a certain AI use case can give rise to both examination and enforcement scrutiny. Companies and firms should avoid using hypothetical or qualifying language like may, which again was consistent with other regulatory disclosures that firms may remember from SEC enforcement actions for firms looking at their disclosures in the Form ADV Part 2A. Also, understand and accurately disclose the risks associated with AI use. As more and more companies adopt AI, including generative AI, as part of their core business functions, certain well-known risks associated with generative AI persist, such as quality control, privacy, IP, etc. Accordingly, these types of disclosures should be very clear and precise about what these risks are.
As seen in matters involving the improper use of hypothetical language, the SEC has previously charged firms for using hypothetical language to describe risks that have materialized. Companies and firms should similarly exercise caution and accuracy in disclosing AI risks that may have emerged, given their firm's operations. In addition, with regard to some of the governance practices inside your firm, make sure the entire firm has defined what is AI internally, including for marketing for your marketing purposes. Firms should consider creating an internal definition of AI to avoid claims of misrepresenting AI usage, and make sure that everyone who's going to be touching AI inside your firms, especially those tasked with trying to explain it, understand exactly what it is they're trying to say. In addition, we think it's helpful for firms to start looking at training your personnel around the risks associated with AI and making sure that they understand the firm's policies around its use. Review these policies regularly. Take a look at your vendors or other service providers, especially for AI systems that are being provided by a vendor. Be careful not to simply repeat the vendor claims about the AI system without taking the appropriate steps to verify the accuracy of those claims as it relates to how your firm is using the AI. Finally, for high-risk AI systems, consider conducting impact assessments to determine foreseeable risks and how to best mitigate those risks, and then consider, again, disclosing those risks in some of the external statements about the firm's AI usage. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Rob Tall, for talking us through the complete compliance toolkit that every CCO needs to build an effective compliance program inside their firm. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on Twitter using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.